Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with influencers to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, August 13th, 2010, I'm delighted to be joined by the authors of a new book, Marketing Lessons from the Grateful Dead, What Every Business Can Learn from the Most Iconic Band in History, by David Bierman Scott and Brian Halligan. And I have at least one of our authors here on the line now.
Hey, Jennifer, it's David. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Where's your co-author?
I'm going to ping him. He's supposed to be here.
Well, that's good. While you do that, I'm going to ask you probably the question that has come up most for you since the book came out, and we should say that the book is out now.
Yes.
It came out not this last Tuesday, but the Tuesday before. So it's something that you can go pick up or order on Amazon right now. But the genesis of the idea, the Grateful Dead and marketing, who's responsible for that, if not both of you?
We both are, actually, because what happened was both Brian and I have been fans of the band since we were teenagers. So I saw my first show in 1979 when I was in high school, and Brian a couple of years later when he was in high school. And we've sort of always been fans, and Brian's seen the band 100 times, over 100 times. I've seen them probably now a bit more than 50 times. And we're both marketing guys, too. So we've always been thinking about this concept of the Grateful Dead as an intriguing marketing example. I've written about them in other of my book projects, and Brian has also written about it in his books, and we've also talked about it on the speaking circuit. So it was interesting that about 6 months or so ago, Brian sent me a tweet, and he said, "Hey, DM Scott, we should do a webinar on marketing lessons from the Grateful Dead." And so I tweeted back and said, "Yeah, that sounds like fun." And I'm like thinking to myself, "Yeah, right, we're going to do this." And he was serious. He was serious. He wasn't going to let it go. And he's like, "Okay, when are we going to do it? Give me a date." And I'm like, so I threw out, "How about April Fool's Day?" So we decided we would do it April Fool's Day. And we did. And what was fascinating was that it actually got tons of people who showed up. I think we had 1,700 people who came into this webinar. So that showed us that they were sort of onto something here. And so then right after that, we kind of were joking and said, "Well, maybe we should write a book." And, you know, ha, ha, ha. And then we go on to another subject. And then I got to talking with my publisher, Matt Holt at Wiley. I've done, I think, 4 books with him. And he goes, "Hey, you guys should do a book." So it just seemed like there's a cosmic-style Grateful Dead fate that brought this whole thing together.
Now, we may be joined by Brian. Brian, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that. I was listening in with a big smile on my face.
So we'll let Brian pick up. I've been trying to DM you on Twitter and talk at the same time, and I used to be able to multitask pretty well. I'm not so good at it anymore. So maybe you can be more coherent in terms of how we came together.
No, I thought you nailed it. One of the influences to me when we were first getting started on this is there was a symposium about the Grateful Dead at the University of Massachusetts in, I think it was 2007 that I went to, and there was a great panel on the business of the Grateful Dead, and a guy named Glenn Rifkin from the New York Times was on it, and the Grateful Dead's former manager, and it started clicking in my head. It's like, wow, gosh, the Dead really were clever in a lot of ways from a business and a marketing perspective, and so it was kind of stuck in the back of my head for a few years. So I was thrilled to finally get it out of my head and onto a book.
Yeah, no kidding, right, Brian?
have you had feedback from anyone you met at the symposium about the fact that you went ahead and got this book out?
We have. In fact, Glenn Rifkin has been in touch with us a few times about it, and he was quite interested in the book and engaged us around the topic. The other person I heard at the symposium speak really eloquently about the Grateful Dead was Bill Walton, the famous basketball player who's the world's tallest deadhead, 6'11", and he's been to 750 Dead shows. And we got him involved with the book, and he wrote just a really interesting introduction to the book, and it's been fun getting to know him through this project.
Yeah, so I mean, I've had the great benefit of reading the book, and if you go through the table of contents and then go to the foreword, as you mentioned, by Bill Walton, the basketball legend and deadhead. You know, I love the. I think that's a picture of him right before the foreword.
Yes,
versus, am I right?
Yes,
yep.
Absolutely. And that was taken at a show. That's actually at a New Year's show, and he played Father Time at the New Year's show, and that's where that photograph was taken. Some 6'11" red-haired Father Time coming in. It's like, whoa, we're gonna have a good year this year.
So is. I guess, coming from the perspective of the UMass Symposium and the business of the Grateful Dead, what are some of the key components for those that have yet to read the book that you can share about the marketing aspect of their business? Because when I think a lot of people think about the Grateful Dead, they don't think necessarily about the business aspect, but specifically the fact that they were, at least as much as I remember, you know, it's like their fan following. It just seemed like by the time they reached my consciousness was just, you know, out of control and completely loyal. And so, you know, obviously they built to that. So what were some of the marketing lessons that you learned that were specific to them that you called out in the book that people can learn from?
Sure. I can take a first crack at that, Dave. So sure. Just riffing on the Bill Walton Father Time. When the Grateful Dead first started, they were the house band in the mid-60s for Ken Kesey's acid test party. So Ken Kesey, people know the Electric Kool-Aid books and all. He threw these LSD parties, essentially, and the Grateful Dead would play as the house band. And what Ken Kesey wanted those parties to be, he didn't want a bunch of people to show up and listen to the band. He wanted everyone at the party to be part of the entertainment. And there were these wild, wild parties, and people wore crazy costumes, and they played funky instruments and made interesting sounds and were wild dancers. And that has really stuck with the Grateful Dead over time. The crowd, David and I were at a few Dead shows last week, is a big part of the entertainment of the show. The music's just fantastic and people love it, but there's a circus-like atmosphere that exists around the Grateful Dead concert that's unlike any other concert. And half the fun of the show is to see all the people in costumes and the crazy dancing and the crazy stuff for sale in the parking lot. And the Grateful Dead were very smart about how they encouraged their fans to be part of the show and how it enhanced the show, and they encouraged that eccentricity of the crowd. That was one of 19 little aspects that we noticed that were smart. And Dave, you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, so they really treated fans as an important part of the whole vibe. You know, the Grateful Dead toured as the Grateful Dead from 1965 until 1995. That was the time of the death of Jerry Garcia, and they didn't tour anymore as the Grateful Dead, but various incarnations of the surviving members have continued on and continue to tour to this day. And by bringing the fans along as sort of equal partners in this, they developed just an incredibly loyal following. So we kind of looked at how can other businesses learn from this, because it's not just rock bands that can do this. And we found, you know, a number of examples of organizations that build loyal followings. And one of our favorites that we wrote about in one of the chapters is Burton Snowboards. You know, in the late 1970s, Jake Burton invented the snowboard by strapping on some ski bindings onto a snurfer, and then, you know, refining that and then actually starting to manufacture them. But at the time, ski mountains wouldn't allow them. It's like, well, you're not on skis, so you can't come here. And so he developed a following of fans of snowboarding, and together, in a sort of countercultural way, almost like the Grateful Dead, they this group of people built the whole sport of snowboarding, which now is a huge mainstream sport. In fact, it's so big now, it's an Olympic sport, and Shaun White, who happens to ride a Burton snowboard, is one of the most famous, not just athletes, but one of the most famous people in the world. And that whole concept of Burton snowboards could never do that by themselves. The only way to do that was to bring along a whole bunch of fans of snowboarding as mutual partners in a journey, the journey of popularizing the sport enough that they could be welcome at ski mountains all over the world.
So I go ahead, Brian.
I would even rip on that. What was interesting about that, another chapter we wrote about, was how the Grateful Dead, just like Burton Snowboards did, kind of created their own category of music. And they were a little bit jazz, a little bit rock and roll, a little bit blues, all kind of melded together with this heavy improvisational element on top of it. And it was very, very unique at the time. And if you go and you go to a record store and you go to the rock section, the blues section, they didn't fit neatly into any category. They sort of created their own category, this jam band category, that many other bands have followed in their footsteps, like Phish. And I sort of think, as a modern day marketer, it's very important that you think about, how do I redraw the boundaries of my industry and try to create my own category? The nice thing about the internet is it opens you up to tons of potential competitors. The bad thing is it opens you up to tons of potential, it opens up lots of potential customers. It opens you up to lots of potential competitors too. So in some way, shape, or form, you need to be unique. And if you're unique on the internet, wow, you can really spread the word quickly. So I think the lesson from the Grateful Dead is, be careful, don't follow your competition's footsteps. Rethink the boundaries of your industry and really innovate on your product. And if you innovate in your product, you can build something really sustainable and interesting. And Burton did that as well.
So, I mean, early in the book, you kind of outline a few examples of the takeaways of the book. And there's only four of them, so I thought it would be worth, for listeners that may be new to it, to think about, you know, what some of the concepts are. So one of them is what you were just talking about, which is rethinking traditional industry assumptions. So to some extent, you know, that's creating a category. But really what you're talking about here is the revenue source being on touring rather than album-based, which, you know, has turned out, you know, obviously turned out to be, you know, the experience of going to a Dead show that is legend. The second piece you talk about here is turning your customers into evangelists, something that people like myself are very passionate about. And I think, you know, it's amazing how you were talking about before, you know, how even before the web, the Dead were letting the audience dictate kind of the tone of the events themselves. And then the third one you have here is bypass accepted channels and go direct. So going straight to the fans, letting them know first what would be happening with the band, and then build a huge loyal following. And I want to ask you about that last one, the huge loyal following, because so many people that have started businesses on the web go, how do we create this large, loyal following? And it's interesting, in the next chapter, you talk about the branding and the name component. So I'd love to hear from both of you your perspective on sort of that last point and how you create and build a large, loyal following that's massive, like the Dead did.
You know, it's really interesting that you asked the question that way, because what we noticed is that you kind of have to do those first three things before you can get that fourth. What I mean by that is, you know, we encounter a lot of people in our work. Brian and I are both business book authors. We're both really, really heavy into the speaking circuit. I do about 50 speeches a year. Brian does a similar number. And Brian also happens to be CEO of a marketing software company, HubSpot. So we're literally every day we're encountering people who are asking us exactly that question. How do I build a large, loyal following? And the companies that seem to be successful at it are the ones that do those first few things. In other words, if you start a company and you just want to be a little bit cheaper than the other guys, or you start a company and you want to be a little bit faster than the other guys, or you start a company and you know you're going to do exactly the same thing as everybody else, but you're going to do it in green. And you know, I'm not exaggerating when there are a lot of businesses out there that that they don't say it this way, but they act as if they're just in a commodity business. You know, they're selling toilet paper, or they're, you know, whatever it is. And it could be, you know, B2B software. It could be, a health, a restaurant. It could be a hotel. It could be, could be a vacation destination, anything. And they come at it from this sort of generic background. You will never build a following, no matter what you do. You will not build a following if you don't think of your business as something that's interesting and unique, and do it from a perspective of passion, from doing it from a perspective of, you know, I don't care how everyone else does business. I'm going to do it my own way. You know, I look at what Brian's been able to achieve with his business with HubSpot. You know, he started his business in 2000, and I think it was 2007, right, Brian?
Yep.
And there was no real category for what he created, inbound marketing. It didn't exist. And so he invented the category, which is risky, but their company had tons of passion, went for it, and it's growing like crazy. And they've got a huge, passionate, loyal fan base of something like 500,000 people, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, but he could never have built that if he said, well, I'm going to just, you know, create another company like everybody else and then try to build a fan base from it. So, you know, without even getting into the techniques yet, you have to start from a base of doing something interesting in a unique way, like the Grateful Dead did or like Brian did with HubSpot, before you even get to the point where you can build a following.
I agree with that.
I was just going to say, Brian, we've had you on this show before. Big fan of HubSpot here at the A-List as well as all the work that you've done, David, and we'll get to how you've how you collaborated. But Brian, do you want to take on that question as well?
Sure.
From the perspective of, you know, how to build that large following, and maybe any insights that you've learned from your own business experience.
Absolutely. So the first chapter, I'm going to rip a little on David's and I'll come in to answer your question. So the first chapter in the book talks about how they innovated, not only on their product, we talked about that a minute ago, but on their business model. And so every other band at the time, let's say the Rolling Stones, would put on a terrific concert, but it was a very repeatable concert, maybe 3 hours long, note for note, the same show night after night. And they used those concerts to sell albums, essentially, and they made all their money on albums. The Grateful Dead sort of flipped that whole model on its head and said, gee, we're going to make money on the concerts themselves, and the albums will be there too. And because they made that fundamental shift in their business model, they did a bunch of things that encouraged a huge following. And one of the things they did that encouraged that huge following was they played a unique show every night, a unique set list every night. It was very improvisational and very unpredictable. So it encouraged knuckleheads like David and I to follow them across the country. So they were making money from us night after night after night. The other thing they did, which really helped build the big following, they were the first inbound marketers. So they let people like David and I come into the show and bring our recording devices. So we could bring our tape recorder in and record the entire show. And then we were free to share that recording, make copies of the tapes with all our friends and neighbors. And that was very, very different from anyone else at the time. And what that did was I would come back from the show with my recording. I would make a copy of it for 3 or 4 of my friends. They would be blaring that music in their dorm room at some party and exposing that music to, you know, 20 people who are at the party. And those 20 people are like, wow, this is pretty interesting music. I'd like to get involved and see a show myself. So each show they played, 2,300, was highly scalable because there were thousands or tens of thousands of mini advertisements these tapes made that pulled in potential customers. And that's very inbound marketing, as we talked about the last time I was on. Businesses should do the same thing. They should create lots and lots of remarkable content about their business, videos, podcasts, blog articles. Each piece of content they create is like a little mini magnet for customers, and it scales in a very similar way. The more content you put out there, the more mini advertisements are out there, just like the Grateful Dead. The more concerts they played, the more tapes, the more customers they got. So that was a real key, is unique product, unique business model, and they were the first inbound marketers, and that's how they got that huge scalable following over time.
So in terms of business model, when you think, for me, when I think of bands, especially the Grateful Dead, you know, and especially the way Jerry Garcia is so beloved, I'm here on the West Coast, you guys are out on the East Coast, and I, you know, especially here in the Bay Area, you know, it's you know, Jerry Garcia was a very beloved figure, and a lot of people talked about what would happen to people like Phil Lesh and other members of the band after he passed away, and certainly, you know, there is this sort of, at least here, this palpable sense of affection for the band. So, you know, one thing that kind of struck me about the concept of the book was that I don't think of the Grateful Dead necessarily as marketers or people that came up with a special business model. So I guess the question that I would love for you to answer for the audience that you know, have not yet been exposed to the book is how much of this was made up on the fly and we can now define in terms that, you know, partially have been created by people like yourself, Brian, and partially was you know, great band management or really a band that was clever and up for anything. How much of, you know, how much of the business aspect was really baked into what actually happened as they were going along?
That's a really interesting question, which we don't know the exact answer to because people that we've asked who are certainly in the know are a little bit cagey about how they answer it. We asked that question of Bob Weir and got kind of a smile. We asked that question of Billy Kreutzmann, and he, you know, he gave us a bit of an answer. We've done a lot of reading on it. Basically, in the very beginning, we're not really sure that they said, well, we're going to create something new and different. You know, it's just the way they are. That's the people they chose to be a part of the band, you know, Lesh coming from a jazz background and Garcia coming from a bluegrass background. And, you know, they just different band members came together. Not that they would say, let's create an eclectic band. It's just that's who they liked to play with, and that's how it was created. The things around the taping and the developing of the the following and treating people to sort of creating a community was not necessarily that they said in 1965 when they formed, let's do our marketing in such a way that we create a social network and a community. Unlikely they did anything like that. It was more, though, around every decision they made seemed to be a decision that the answer fell to what would be the best for the community. So when they were forced to make some kind of choice, for example, the choice of in many cities, the police departments wanted to crack down on the parking lot scenes that happen for the entire day prior to a show. People would show up in the morning, you know, and then throughout the afternoon and have this massive circus-like party in the parking lot prior to the show and you know, all sorts of things go on in the parking lot. And many of the cities sort of said, well, you know, gosh, we don't want this here. So rather than crack down and say, oh, okay, well, we're going to do a show and we're going to have the police come and break up the parking lot scene, the Grateful Dead said, we're not going to play there then. That's just a city we're not going to go to. And yeah, they disappointed fans who wanted to go hear the music in those particular cities, but they would rather do that than break up what they knew was an integral part of their community, which is when people get together prior to the shows and have a chance to party and meet friends and whatnot. So Our suspicion is that it wasn't so much that they said, oh, we're going to create a really huge band and we're going to make lots of money because we're going to do all the social networking sites. It was stuff. It was more like, let's do what's right for the fans. Let's do what's right for the community. If that brings us money, great. If it doesn't, we'll still enjoy the fact that we've got this community that supports us.
Yeah, I would second that. I'd say everything I read about Jerry Garcia is just trying to do the right thing by the fans. But what I really respect about them is something that a business school professor, Arnaldo Hacks, that I had at MIT, he's kind of a famous strategy professor. He would always say the same phrase over and over again, Brian, watch your competition, but never follow them. And it's so much easier to follow the competition and follow the muddied herd in your industry. Jerry didn't give a hoot what other bands were doing. He was trying to do the right thing by the fans. And so he was watching what was going on, but he very much had his own mind and made his own decisions. But I think that's a lesson for every business today. It's so easy to follow the industry and the competition. And by definition, you're probably going to die by following people and not innovating. And I really respect Garcia and the Dead for doing that.
Interesting. That's a great concept and takeaway that, you know, at the end of the day, it was about their uniqueness. And, you know, had they decided to become, you know, create these repeatable shows, as you mentioned, you know, the Rolling Stones is another band that kind of started out around the same time maybe a little bit before, I think, maybe.
Around the same time, yeah. I think the Stones might have been a couple of years earlier, but not many.
Yeah, very much a sort of stage concert, and today that's kind of what we see is these big, you know, shows that have, you know, visual elements rather than being focused on sort of the jam session. What I thought was interesting about both of your answers is that you referred very much to Jerry Garcia in your answer, and I just wanted to ask you about that, about the fact that you referred to Jerry Garcia specifically as opposed to other band members, and maybe explain for the audience why that is.
You want to jump, Brian?
Yeah, in talking with their drummer, Billy Kreutzmann, and in talking with people around the band, I was actually surprised. We did a lot of research for the book. It was Jerry's band more than I thought. Jerry was a reluctant leader, but he was the leader, and he made the rules, and he made most of the decisions. So when the band, all through the years, from the business side, they would get together once a week around a big table and talk about the business aspects. Jerry was an affable guy and all that, but at the end of the day, he was kind of making the calls and he was the leader of the band. And if someone was out of line, he would push on them. I was frankly surprised to see that. I thought it was more egalitarian than that, but Jerry was making the calls. He was the force behind the band. Much of the stuff around the taping and all that, he drove a lot of that, actually. Unfortunately, we never got the chance to talk to Jerry, but in talking to other band members, we were surprised at how much of the behind the scenes he was really in control.
And the other thing that sort of proves that point is that, you know, that he was both the spiritual leader as well as kind of the leader in the eyes of the fans as well, is that, throughout the years, sadly, members of the band passed away. And in the early days, Pigpen, who was the original organist, he was also a vocalist, he passed away. And the band never broke up until Jerry Garcia passed away. And then they never toured again as the Grateful Dead. I think that had anybody else passed before Jerry, my suspicion, although we'll never know, but my suspicion is they probably would have continued as the Grateful Dead. And, of course, all the band members are still touring in various incarnations, and they have toured as the Dead, not the Grateful Dead, but the Dead. When Jerry died, that was the end of the band as a touring entity, although it still lives on as a very profitable corporation that sells merchandise and CDs and whatnot. It still lives on from the business perspective. He was pretty much the leader,
Yeah. I'll even add on. So here, I'm sitting here at HubSpot headquarters in Cambridge, and we name conference rooms after people who influence our business strategy. So we have a conference room name, for example, for Mark Benioff, the CEO of Constant Contact, for Steve Jobs, the CEO of Apple, for Clayton Christensen, who wrote The Innovator's Dilemma, so forth and so on. We have a Jerry Garcia conference room. It turns out he was a very creative, thinks outside the box, extremely bright guy, not just musically, but in the way he thought about how to build a community in the band. He's been very influential on how we built our business, and I think this book, through this book, he'll influence lots and lots of other businesses and business models.
Interestingly, getting to sort of the, as you said, it's sort of a shame that you didn't get to interview Jerry himself, but, you did do a lot of research. You referred to the research. I think, it would be interesting to let us in a little bit into how you're not just the research process, but the writing process for both of you who, are very passionate about the band itself actually came together in going from the tweeting amongst one another to even the first, it sounds like you did a webinar initially, and correct me if I'm wrong on that, but and then decided to take it to one of your publishers and got the green light, or it was suggested that you go ahead and go with this. So I'm just curious about sort of, I always love to get insights on, smart minds collaborating, because you might be thinking alike, but it's the finer points that sometimes we get stuck on. So, how did you collaborate?
So the good news is Brian and I, although we have an amazing amount of things in common, we both love the Dead. We're both marketing types. We both lived in Asia for 10 years. I mean, it's a really interesting, or nearly 10 years. It's really interesting things, almost like long-lost brothers. We come at business from some slightly different perspectives. Brian is much smarter than me. He has an MBA and is also an entrepreneur in residence at MIT, which I can't even understand. And I come at it from a different perspective. So it was good that we had, like the Grateful Dead, we had different viewpoints as we came into the process. Had we been perfectly identical in the way we thought about things, I don't know that it would have come across as well. We decided early on that we were going to take different thoughts and riff on them, and some of those thoughts ended up becoming chapters, some of them didn't. But we started with independent ideas, then we came together and we worked on the chapters together. The other thing that made the process a lot easier than we both thought it might have been was we had a lot of these ideas already in our minds. Brian put a chapter in his book, Inbound Marketing. I've had references in all of my books to the band. We both used them as examples from the podium. So we've been doing a lot of deep thinking for decades about the band and its marketing. So it's not like, oh my gosh, we have to research this topic from zero. We were starting at like 75% and the research got us to 100, as opposed to people who typically write books that start at a base of 5 or 10 or 15% and then have to get up to 100. So we were really lucky there, combined 150 Dead shows between us as background. So that aspect was pretty cool. And then we very early on got Jay Blakesburg involved. He has been the Grateful Dead's official photographer for years. We were able to have access to his entire photo archive. But in that process, I got to know him, and we've actually become friends. I went to his studio, I think, 3 different times, and he gave us some amazing insight that we never would have been able to get, from somebody who's part of the extended Grateful Dead family, but not an actual band member, and what his viewpoint of all these various ideas are. I'm actually surprised that although the process did have its moments, it was a lot easier than I had originally thought it might be.
Yeah, there's an interesting story about how David and I met. Actually, the two of us, I started this company, HubSpot, which is kind of a marketing transformation software company. that mm-hmm. talks a lot about the same stuff that's in David's famous book, The New Rules of PR Marketing. So about 6 months after I started the company, I sent an email to David saying, hey, you want to get together? We're building the software. We're thinking similar things about how marketing is broken and how you need to transform it. And so he came by, and we sat down, shook hands, and he opened his computer up, and so I could see the back of his computer. And on his computer, he had a Grateful Dead Steal Your Faith sticker on there. And so for the first half hour of the meeting, we talked about the Grateful Dead. He ended up couldn't go to a Phil and Friends, Phil Lesh's band, concert the next week, gave me his ticket. And we've ended up seeing a whole bunch of Dead shows and other types of music together and become quite good friends through this. So that was a very, very interesting way to meet and kick this thing off. And then we both think a lot alike about this marketing transformation stuff. So it was really a passion, a project of passion for the both of us. We both love marketing. We both love the Dead. And it was probably the funnest project I've ever worked on, where I got to combine two of the things that I just think the most about and that I really love.
And I can't believe that David Halligan just said funnest on the show, because, you know, you are one of the smartest guys out there. I love that you just used that phrase.
Funnest. So,
I'll just point that one out, because that was kind of cool that you said that. But you know, I think that there's clearly a lot in what you discussed there. I do want to go back to the topic of research, because I think that that's one of the aspects that makes your book really strong, is that you know, it's not just sort of a ripoff in terms of title. You know, let's get, you know, people that remember and love the Grateful Dead to buy this book. You actually did do your homework. So I'm curious, in terms of that piece of it, you know, and maybe this is the Columbia J School grad in me, I really would love to know how you tackled the, you know, research and not, you know, doubling up. And I'm sure other leads came from the interviews. And so then you know, did you pursue them directly, or did you confer? So how did that process work?
Yeah, I'll jump in. So we knew that there are a lot of people out there who have equal passion for this band, if not more passion for this band than we do. And, you know, there are, for example, people who we call set list savants, who maintain incredibly complex databases of every single song the band has ever played and do predictive analysis on what song is likely to be the opener at the next show. I mean, really amazingly intricate, amazing stuff. And so we knew we had to get it right, and we couldn't just make it a fluffy piece. It had to be, you know, it had to have some meat in it. So we came at it from the perspective of we got to get this right. So, as I said, we come at it from, you know, 25 years of each of us having experience with the band and having thought about it, which is a great place to start. We read a whole bunch of books. I mean, all the recognized books on the subject. I voraciously read. It's all I read for like 3 months was biographies and books about the band and by the band members and by the roadies and whatnot, which was really fun. We got connected with the Grateful Dead Archive at the University of California in Santa Cruz, and we ended up actually donating 25% of our royalties to the archive, but got together with the archive and brought them into the fold a little bit. We talked with people who are associated with the band, you know, for first-person interviews, to try to learn stuff that we couldn't find written down. We approached a number of the band members themselves and ended up having a conversation before the book was published with Bill Kreutzmann. Afterwards, we met Bob Weir, but not before the book was published. So really, you know, really wanted to try to understand as much as we could as we were writing and before we started writing to try to get some of this stuff right. Brian actually started the research process way before we even got the book going, because as he mentioned earlier, we attended this symposium.
Yeah. One of the funnest parts of the research was a private tour we got of the Grateful Dead archives. So the Grateful Dead generously donated all their documentation, all their stuff, basically, to the University of Santa Cruz's library, and that's the Grateful Dead Archive Project. And they took a subset of all that stuff, and they put on an exhibition at the New York Historical Society that was really neat. And David and I both went and saw it several times. But we got a private tour of that with Billy Kreutzmann, the Dead's drummer, where he walked us through a lot of the stuff and answered a ton of questions and was just really, really helpful in getting the firsthand, firsthand right from the horse's mouth information about what was going on in the band and the business decisions and the taping decisions and the mailing lists and all that stuff. He was a treasure trove of information, just a terrific guy too, really mellow cat. Super helpful to us, and that was one of the funner pieces of research that we got to do on the book.
Very, very cool. So, one area in terms of the business aspects that is interesting that touches on something you talked about earlier in terms of being able to bring your own recording devices. So you got, you could share and get a taste of each unique set of music that was played, each experience, but that ultimately there was sort of an upgrade that fans could do by purchasing the music. Do you want to talk about that and how that relates to a core, piece of business strategy these days?
Hey, Brian, why don't you talk about the taping and what it means for today, and then I can pick up on the whole buying the CD thing.
Yeah, I think the taping was absolutely fascinating to let people do that. I remember in undergrad, I lived in a dorm, and I probably had 200 shows that I had taped, and they were all really crappy recordings that weren't directly from there. A couple from the soundboard, but they were really crappy. And my friend Mickey next door, he had over 1,000, so he really walked on water when it came to the Dead shows. And we spent a lot of time trading tapes back and forth and really having fun with it. And I just think, as I look back about it, it's like, wow, was that a smart marketing move on the part of the Grateful Dead? Because if anyone ever had a birthday, I always made them a copy of my favorite and best quality show I had on tape and draw a nice little thing on the cover and give it to them. And that's how they spread the word about their music. It was an absolutely genius way to spread their word about the music by counterintuitively giving it away. And I really respect him for it, because that's basically my life these days, is teaching businesses how to transform the way they market by giving stuff away, by giving stuff between their ears away through their blog, through their videos, through their podcasts, and using that content, that IP, to pull more customers in and to spread the word virally through Twitter, through Facebook, through LinkedIn, all these social media sites. So That piece of the whole story is my very favorite piece, because they truly were the first inbound marketers on the planet.
And they must have sold 100 million Maxell UDXL2 cassettes.
They must have.
that's the brand I used, at least. That was the one I saw used a lot. And I collected tapes too. I don't know that I had as many as your roommate, but I had a few, or your dorm mate. The other thing that they did was interesting, was they realized that after people got a taste of this music, that they were itching for some better quality. So they had this upgrade path where you could actually buy directly from the band. There's a whole series of CDs called Dick's Picks. There's another set of series of called Road Trips. And then, interestingly, in the later years, following Jerry's death, what they do is they actually create CDs of shows while you're there. So the way it works is, and I did this last weekend when I saw, or 2 weekends ago, whenever it was, when we saw Further, is you pay $20 or $25, whatever the price is, at the merchandise table, the place where you buy T-shirts, and then they give you a wristband. You put the wristband on, and then you enjoy the show. And then the Grateful Dead famously does two sets. They do an hour and a half, roughly, take a half hour break, do another hour and a half, take a real short break, and then do an encore. So it's a really long concert. So typically they'll be creating the first set of CDs at the set break. Then they'll record the second set, do it as the band breaks for the encore, and then they'll start making the next set of CDs immediately after the last note is played on the encore. And they'll deliver this 3D set packaged up really nicely to the people who bought the wristbands, and it's delivered approximately 15 minutes after the show is over. And so, yeah, you can bring in your gear and record the show for free, and then band encourages you to do so and even gives you a spot in the best place to record for sound quality. But if you want an even better quality CD of that show, that night that it's done, you do it this way. And we met people at some of the shows. I said, well, why do you do this? You know, you can get it for free. And, this one guy told me, well, I live in, he was at a show in the Boston area, and he says, I live in Vermont, and it's a three-hour drive home, and I want to listen to the show that I just saw and relive it again right away, so I do the CD thing, even though I could download it as soon as I get home. So this idea of a so-called freemium model just makes so much sense for a lot of businesses to use. Give something away for free and then have an upgrade path where they can buy the better quality. Kindle comes to mind there, Amazon Kindle. You get a free Amazon Kindle application for your iPhone. You can get a free Amazon Kindle application for your iPad, and you can download the books and read them on those devices. But if you want something with a little better quality, you spend $249 and buy an actual Kindle.
Exactly. So one of the things that probably my favorite chapter in this, we had Seth Godin on. We were lucky enough before Lynchpin came out, and it reminded me of reading that book. But the chapter 19 where you say, do what you love, and you said, because the Grateful Dead loved what they did, they stuck with it, and in parentheses you say, obviously, eventually it prospered. And what you do very cleverly in each of the sections is that you relate it to another example of success. In this case, a more traditional business success, you actually relate it to Bill Gates. Do you want to talk a little bit about doing what you love and making that profitable? Because both of you are, have been very, very successful at doing that outside of this book.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I would sort of take, this is Brian, I took the lead on that one. I'm honored that you like that chapter. What I always noticed about Jerry in seeing him up on stage and looking at a lot of recordings in researching the book and then looking at every interview I could find of him online, there's not a ton. He was one happy camper. He always had a big old smile on his face when he was up on stage. His fingers dancing up and down the frets, and he was just awfully happy. And the thing that I think so interesting about Jerry and the Dead is when they first started out, they were so poor that Jerry lived in his car. He couldn't afford an apartment.
Oh, my goodness.
And his main source of protein was he would go to the local fast food restaurant, take the free ketchup packets, pour them in some hot water, and that was his tomato soup. And he lived on a lot of tomato soup in those early days. Their first gig, they had a two-night gig in some place, the name escapes me, in Palo Alto.
It was a pizza bar.
Yeah, a pizza bar. They were so bad after the first night that the owner said, basically, don't come back the second night, and replace them with three like elderly men playing like the clarinet, the bass, and the drums, just like this awful replacement, that they were that bad. And, that was pretty rough. And they loved what they did. Jerry loved what they did, and they just doubled down and keep practicing and practicing and practicing, and they eventually honed their craft and got better and better. And I think there's a lesson for, I speak to a lot of MBA students here at MIT and Harvard Business School, and I think you're much, much better off going into an industry or doing a job that you're absolutely passionate about and you love, even if it's in a crappy industry. So, for example, I would encourage somebody who's really into cars to go to work for GM or Ford or Fiat or one of these companies. They're much better off doing that than going to a lifeless investment banker job at Goldman Sachs or a lifeless management consulting job at McKinsey, because you're just, first of all, you're going to end up riding through those highs and lows much better, like the Grateful Dead did, and you're going to be passionate. It's going to get you through that. Second of all, you're likely to really shine even in a crappy industry. And third of all, if you do what you love, you never really work a day in your life. You spend at least half your waking hours doing your job. And if you're doing something that's absolutely miserable, like investment banking and slaving over a hot spreadsheet all day, that does something to you inside karmically that can't be good for you. And so my advice to people is do what you love, get a great mattress, and get a great job, and you'll be much better off because you spend 90% of your life on your mattress and in your job.
That is so true. One of the best, before I give you a chance to answer, David, and we're in our last 10 minutes, but I should say my husband convinced me to make the investment in a Tempur-Pedic bed, and
nice.
I swear to God, I cannot be, even though I was sort of skeptical that a bed could do what Tempur-Pedic said, it was so worth the time and energy to buy that. I can't even tell you because you do spend so much time in bed.
And look at that. Now you're using Grateful Dead marketing to help sell Tempur-Pedic mattresses. For
I know. And I lived in Sweden for a year. So you know, maybe it's that Scandinavian connection.
Yeah.
David, did you want to chime in on that question?
Well, you know, or? What I find so interesting about that concept is that here's Brian and I doing exactly that. I mean, I love the Grateful Dead. I love marketing. I'm making a living by writing and speaking and talking about the Grateful Dead style marketing. I mean, we're both living proof that this idea it absolutely works. I mean, I could very well, and I look at some of the choices I made in my career. I could very well have been a marketing director at a company somewhere, you know, punching the clock and doing my thing, and having an okay life. But here I am, just enjoying every day. I can't wait to do my thing. You know, I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and jump on Twitter. I mean, I know many people. For some people, that may be crazy, but you know, I'm not. They wouldn't want the life I have, but here I am doing what I love, and it's working out absolutely terrifically.
And that's awesome. And we should say that you know, people can actually meet you in person that are in the San Francisco Bay Area. Of course, the show's listened to everywhere, but this coming Wednesday, I'm involved. I'm with the local social media club chapter and on the board. And David, you'll be here in San Francisco for a tweet up. Hopefully you'll be, I don't know if you'll be signing books or if you'll be so gracious to, but
I'm looking forward to doing this one. Yeah. I've got a speaking gig, in the area, and then swinging by the Search Engine Strategies Conference, where I'll be signing copies of Marketing Lessons of the Grateful Dead, and then that evening we're doing this tweet up. Are you going to be there?
I'm hoping to be there
to meet you
in person,
I'm going to actually. It's not a secret anymore because I'm going to announce it right now. I'm going to be giving away copies of my not the Grateful Dead book, but the one just prior to that one called Worldwide Rave for the first 40 people who went to the door.
Awesome.
I will definitely sign those books. Any other books that come through the door, happy to sign. I love doing tweet-ups. They're so much fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. And, you know, there is a charity event after the event that we're at Social Media Club promoting as well. So it kind of goes to the charity piece of your book as well, where you're donating, a good chunk of the proceeds to UC Santa Cruz and their I think it's called an archive, right?
Yeah, the Grateful Dead archive, and it's the University of Santa Cruz library that's housing it. And Brian and I are donating 25% of our royalties, which is, you know, it's exciting for us to be able to share that way, because they are keeping the actual documents that scholars and future generations will look at to learn how the band did their marketing. There's actual contracts, for example, that they wrote, the minutes from the meetings, the weekly meetings that they held. I mean, if I ever get an opportunity to spend a couple of days, I'd love to sort of pour through some of these documents, because it'd really be fascinating. They actually have a project now to digitize all the archives to make them available to people like us who are interested in them. And part of the revenue that they generate from us, which is modest in terms of the number they need to, they need millions to do this properly, will help them to be able to preserve this for future generations. The largest collection of 1960s memorabilia in the world.
Fascinating. And it also almost, UC Santa Cruz almost held the Hitchcock School of Film, because Alfred Hitchcock lived his last years in that area. So, so much iconic pop culture being around UC Santa Cruz. Fabulous that you're donating a good chunk of proceeds from the book. So kudos to you on that. And again, Wednesday at Supper Club in San Francisco, 6 o'clock is the time. And if you need more information, you can always tweet me, or I'm sure David would be happy to tell you more about that event. But I want to get back to one question that I wanted to make sure I asked you. Speaking of other generations, maybe those that missed the Dead in its heyday when they were still touring, you know, and it reminds me of David when we were setting this up, and I thought you were so cool because you were taking your daughter to Lollapalooza.
That was last weekend.
I was like, I was wondering if there are other, so, you know, I mean, there are other certainly creative types. You know, I've had Zoe Keating on, for example, the sort of avant cellist who has used, she actually designed web pages initially, but used this background and technology to sell and create and have, you know, hold private events and be very successful as a musician. But it didn't even start until her 30s. Again, a lesson on do what you love. But I'm wondering if you find yourself learning from or watching either other creative types, you know, certainly the Obama case study that Edelman did on advocacy, you know, regardless of your political opinion, on advocacy that's very translatable to lots of businesses. If you're finding other lessons out there in maybe what people would consider non-traditional places that you're tracking, sort of in the way that you were able to do so with the Grateful Dead.
Brian?
I'm inspired all over the place. you can't help be inspired by these boys at Apple. My goodness, are they churning out some fantastic products out there. So innovative, rejecting conventional wisdom. I'm pretty inspired by the folks at Salesforce.com. I write about it in the book, about how transparent they are. They have a site called success.salesforce.com. So anytime their application goes down, they tell the whole world that it's down right now, here's what happened, here's what the problem is. So rather than trying to hide the problem, they're extremely kind of transparent about it. So those are two in the book that I thought were kind of interesting that we wrote about.
How could you not? If you have a, I think this could have been a chapter in the book, although it didn't, but if you have a curious mind, you just see interesting things that you can relate all over the place. And, you know, this next generation idea that you just mentioned, you know, when we've gone to shows in the very beginning, we were on the young side, we were high school kids, and we looked up to these older deadheads that had seen them since the 60s, and like, wow, you know, they've been doing it since the 60s. And then sort of in the 80s and 90s, I'd look, you know, I'm getting a little bit older into my 20s and even into my 30s. I'm looking and seeing the teenage deadheads. Wow, you know, the Grateful Dead's been around for 30 years, and here are these 18-year-olds who are really, really getting into them. Isn't that great? And now we're 45 years later, and Jerry Garcia has been has been dead for 15 years, 16 years, whatever it's been, 15, I guess. And there is another generation. My daughter is 17, and I'm seeing, you know, kids who are her age at some of these shows, that there were a bunch of them at Gathering of the Vibes 2 weekends ago. So I'm pretty convinced that the Grateful Dead and their music is going to live on like, I don't know, like Dizzy Gillespie's music, or like Thelonious Monk's music, and I mean, in a way that other people are playing it and interpreting it. So even though the Grateful Dead itself isn't around anymore, there's a lot of bands who are interpreting the music. Many bands are doing covers of their songs, you know, the original songs that they wrote. There's at least 20 or 30 bands, Dark Star Orchestra comes to mind as the premier example, who are playing their music night after night and making a good living doing it, because so many people want to continue to hear the music. And it's not just people like Brian and I who had an opportunity to see Jerry Garcia play. It's people who are too young to have experienced Jerry Garcia play. So I wouldn't be surprised if 100 years from now, you know, much like a classical musician lives on for hundreds of years, you know, Bach or whoever, I mean, we've got the Grateful Dead music 100 years from now. I would not be surprised.
Amazing.
Let me just rip on that a little bit on kind of creativity. So I think there's a lot of research being done on creativity today. And I think this is a very creative exercise by David and I to do this. So there's two things I do around creativity that help me that might be useful to others. First thing I do is just read everything I can. So, for example, right now I'm reading Daniel Pink's new book. It's just great. Mm. Book Drive. Love the book. And as I read the book, I take notes in the book, or I take notes in my iPhone, and I use those notes to inspire stuff I do at HubSpot. And I always make tons of new initiatives and changes at my business whenever I'm reading a new book. Kind of drives my employees crazy. The second thing I do, there's a great article in the New Yorker about how you do breakthrough, really creative thinking. And it turns out the science around it says to have a creative breakthrough thought, what you need to do is first relax, you know, get a massage, lie in bed with the lights out, take a shower, and then let your mind wander. If you want a breakthrough thought about topic X, the worst thing you can do sometimes is think about topic X. It's just let your mind wander. And then you have that aha moment like Newton had when the apple hit him on the head. And so I tried to budget time in my calendar, not to just be doing email and doing stuff, but to just think and block everything out and try to come up with sort of very creative breakthrough ideas. I think people today in society just spend too much time in their email and their browser, and they have no time to think and have breakthrough thoughts. And some stuff, like a lot of the stuff that came out of the book, came through some of that relaxing, introspective, mind-wandering time that I built into my calendar.
Very, very cool. We are over time, guys. And
yes,
I really thank you so much for spending the time to talk deeply and thoughtfully about the book. I'm thrilled, Brian, that you brought up a B2B case study of Salesforce.com, success.salesforce.com specifically. That's one that in specializing in B2B or business-to-business as opposed to business-to-consumer, which is what we think of with a band, you know, there's definitely relatable examples in almost every section of the book. I'm a huge fan of the book, guys, and I cannot endorse it more. Again, want to remind everybody that they can meet David in person if they are in the San Francisco Bay Area this coming Wednesday, and they can check out my Twitter stream, which is linked from the Blog Talk Radio page as well as from iTunes, for more on that. And I want to thank you, Brian Halligan and David Meerman Scott, for making time to spend with us today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Really, really a pleasure.
Great, great time. Thanks so much. I'll let you guys get on with the rest of your day. And I want to thank every listener out there for being a part of the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Remember to tweet, Facebook, or email in your questions for all of our guests. The show is by you and for you. So it's important that we get your feedback. And if you like the show, we'd be delighted if you'd friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio or rate us on iTunes. Be sure to tune in next week at 12 noon Pacific when we'll have some special guests on that I'll be announcing during the week. And in the meantime, have a fabulous weekend. Take care.